everyone, and welcome. This is Victoria Stapleton, Director of School and Library Marketing at Little Brown Books for Young Readers. Oh, friends and listeners across the universe, on the other end of my phone, the partner in crime today, the jam to my scone, the lemon to my tea, the cozy to my tea. I can't even think of how many things that I would like to say about this woman. My guest today is Gail Carriger.
Hello.
I can't. My papers are all a-quiver with my excitement to have you with me. Gail, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited.
I will tell listeners that you are the author of three series. The Parasol Protectorate, which is where I first fell in love with you by stealing the books off the shelves at the office and inhaling them and then pestering the Orbit staff to give me the latest book. Then the Finishing School series, War, Little Brown Books for Young Readers, Etiquette and Espionage, Waistcoats and Weaponry, Manners and Mutiny, and the fourth book coming out. And then I know the first book in the series is Prudence, and I know it involves custard.
It's called the Custard Protocol series.
I do love custard. I do love custard.
Me too. That was the reason I named it that, at least in part. It's because of certain things in my books people have taken to gifting me with a tribute, as I call it, when I do author events. And so they give me tea and octopi, and I thought, I love custard, so I'll just name the next book after something I really want people to give me.
Clearly, you are a very smart woman. And I'm excited about this discussion today because we're going to talk a little bit about balance. And I think you have a really interesting way of building your stories that allows for the balance or tension, and we'll discover which one it is, between the author and the reader and between plot and character. So shall we jump right into it?
Let's do it.
Okay. So you, in the Parasol Protectorate and Finishing School and the Custard Protocol, you have created a distinctive fictional world. I mean, a very distinctive fictional world. You've done a lot of research and you've put quite a bit of thought into this setting. I wonder, how much do you account for your readers' imaginations in building this world, if you do that at all? I mean, I can think of several authors, George Martin, whose world building is so complete the reader doesn't need to do much or anything except scan the words. But do you allow for this type of reader participation?
I like to hope that I do. I'm not married to description as an author, although if you read my books, you'll see I do describe a lot of stuff, but I don't identify with it, I think, as much as, say, an author of epic fantasy might. I don't feel compelled to sort of impress my will upon people as to how characters look or the world looks. It's more important to me to get a sense of atmosphere across, and I think that has to do with my love of Gothic literature, for example. So for me, it's more that atmosphere and setting is a sort of an additional character, and so the characters interact with the world in that way, in the way that they would interact with the characters. So the things that are described about the world are important to knowing about the world as a character and also to important to moving the plot along. And so I do leave some stuff up in the open.
Can you give us a general example of how you do this?
Well, one of the things I do is I gravitate towards objects because my previous career was as an archaeologist. So for me, the objects that inhabit setting are really important, and they also tie very intimately to character. So careful readers will notice that, for example, in the Finishing School books, my spy characters have objects that are sort of associated with them, like Sophronia has a bladed fan, that's her main weapon of choice, and then sort of another minor, slightly more negative character, Prussia, is always interested in poisons and poisoning people, and that's sort of indicative of her secretive nature and personality, whereas the bladed fan is indicative of my main character's kind of sort of fancy aggression in a way. and her sort of behavior as a character. So that's kind of one little insight.
I sort of love that. Again, it speaks to balance. The sort of it's a decorative violence,
mm-hmm.
or a genteel brutality.
Exactly, and I love just juxtaposition. That's one of the reasons the finishing school books are so fun for me. Is there this ultimate tension between the social mores and the governing restrictions on women that are very indicative of Victorian world. But in my world, I get to play with those by making those very restrictions the vehicles by which my female characters carve out freedom and identity, by manipulating a world that wants to impose on them. And that sort of thing is just delicious for me as an author.
I hate to say this because this is a little bit too much more about me. Hi, Mom. I've been reading a lot of poetry lately, and I'm fascinated by the different restrictions, different forms of poetry put on language, and how the success of a poet lies in how they use those restrictions to still be expressive and convey the point. And I think there is a really interesting poetry in how you are using those same constriction. Well, I don't even want to say constriction. I want to say, well, then the word came up was discipline, but that is a whole other podcast on a non-family friendly channel, likely. But it's intriguing to me how you do, there is that tension between role and inhabiting the role and fulfilling the role. I'm also intrigued because one of the things I think of in world building, and I've thought a lot about with this book, is the sense of the history within the world. The history of vampires and the history of werewolves, which I think you have a hint of in your mind as you're writing it, but you're also letting us make it up as we go along. Is that true?
Absolutely. I think one of the things when I was first conceiving of my universe that I thought about a lot was, if immortals, if you hypothesize that there are, say, shapeshifters or vampires being immortal and hanging about, how, first of all, they'd behave as characters who are immortal. So it would be different. If you live for a very, very long time, you just see the world and you see mortal creatures differently, I've always thought. But also that they would be tinkering with history, that they'd be around, that history would have shifted to accommodate them. Or in my case, history could be re-explained by their presence. So one thing that I hypothesize is that the Roman Empire, for example, is dominated, the patricians would have been vampires or vampiric in nature, which explains a lot about the decadence and such. And so I have this whole history in my head of how immortal beings would have been tinkering throughout history and directing the way that the world changes. But I don't, it's not always necessary to write about that, but I know it. And I think that's similar, again, to sort of approaching setting of character, in that I have all of these side characters that are not my main characters, and I know all about them, too. I know their background. I know what it was like for them to grow up, what their parents were like. But it's not necessary for me to tell that to the reader until it is, and then I do. But I know it. And there's a hint, I think, that you can sort of feel that when you're reading an author's universe, that they're confident in their world and their characters in that kind of way.
I call this the fourth dimension of a story, in that there is clearly a world beyond what is in these pages, and I may or may not get to see it, but I have the confidence of making up parts of the story because of the backstory, I should say, because you as the author have that confidence. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think it's fun for readers because they know that there's more to explore and they can explore it themselves through their own imagination. I think it can make a universe story ripe for fan fiction, which is a whole different discussion. But also for cosplay and fan art. And I kind of love the idea that I hope it doesn't leave readers too much wanting more, but I hope it does leave them wanting to imagine and to explore the world on their own.
I think you've done it tremendously well. And something you've said about the objects and atmosphere and these objects having key to the character, Now I'm thinking of something, and you're going to say his name for me because I, as a reader in my mind, have made up how to say this character's name, but I don't listen to audio, so I don't know what the real pronunciation is. Goldenrod is his code name. How do you say that name?
It's Lord Atheldama.
Thank you. I'm actually very close. But thinking about objects and objects is key to character, Lord Akeldama. We'll see. It doesn't roll off my tongue very well. And how he collects people as almost as objects. Oh, see, now I have to go reread and think again. I love this part.
But that's me twisting this idea and giving you insight into what it is, because he's a very old vampire, Lord Akeldama, and he interacts with the world in an almost the world that my characters inhabit, which is the mortal world, in an almost awkward manner. And one expression of that, but I mean, he's consummate, and he's a incredibly skilled social manipulator, but he also collects people in the way that most people would collect objects. And that's kind of me making a statement of his misunderstanding in a strange way of how the world works. And yet, because he is so good at social manipulation, he's kind of allowed to do it and almost admired for it and for his collection. And his collection reflects on him. But it is also slightly sinister, and it's meant to be a little sinister. I, as a writer, never forget that werewolves and vampires are also an apex predator in my universe. So they're meant to eat human beings at the when all is said and done.
I mean, I was thinking as you were speaking, well, he's a vampire, but at least he's our vampire. But then maybe not.
Maybe not, yes, but is he really?
So, continuing on with the idea of balance, how do you balance character development with plot movement? I mean, this goes back to a very long-running discussion, particularly in young adult literature, about is it plot or is it voice, and what do readers read for? Another way to think about this is, what the character, do you think of the character as what the character does versus who the character is? So it can be the balance can play out within the character's mind. Sophia, Sophronia's struggle is, she's gone to the school and now she has to really think about the consequences of really becoming an intelligencer, and that thinking about the consequences of that and her personal desires. But it can also play out in the novel's construction. And so, how do you balance the elements? Is that too much to chew on?
Not really. It's for me, there's a basic core to this is hard to articulate, but for me, there's a basic core to a journey that a main character is going to be taking that's partly dependent on the genre, and that's partly dependent on how I imagine myself at that age. So in Sophronia's case, Sophronia is a reflection or a copy or a parallel or a wish fulfillment of my life in high school. And so there's a lot of things that are part of that part of your life for me, and definitely for me anyway, which is formation of your identity, sort of a breaking with your parental strictures, this hunt for independence, but also finding your first major network, friends that you choose rather than are a consequence of your childhood. And then there's also this thing that always happens, which is a basic shift in understanding where when you're a child, you're innately selfish and necessary for human survival. But as you become an adult, you have to lose that selfishness and find your place in the world and your identity as a political creature, as a sexual creature, and all of those aspects of growing up. And so, I mean, trivializing it, but saying a young adult novel is a novel about growing up is a little trivial, but essentially what's going on is that reformation of identity. And so that's always been in my mind as I wrote the finishing school books. And so it definitely informs the overarching kind of plot of the four books.
Well,
And so,
I would say you're
yeah.
preaching to the choir because you've just defined YA as I always define YA. So I think we're on the same page there, but continue.
And so, how does that play? Yes, I mean, for me, I mean, action is important and plot is important, and the story within each individual book is also very important. But there are lessons, in a way, by which Sophronia is learning this rehash of her own identity. And so each time, she's learning, in other words, the consequences of her choices as they affect other people, which is the basic lesson of going from kid to adult. And so she has to then, she's redefining herself and trying to learn her place in this society that I have, this fantastical society I've created, as a consequence of those lessons that are the result of the plot of each book. So they're, for me, they're very intimately intertwined.
That's interesting, thinking about it this way, going back to the earlier part of our discussion where you're talking about roles for the role of women in those societies, and then sort of working around the definitions, or trying to move the definitions around to suit your purposes, thinking about how Sophronia can look at the requirements or limitations of being an intelligencer, and then sort of twisting those to suit her own purposes.
Absolutely, and she's also learning. I mean, she's a powerful, I wrote her as a powerful character, and she's learning a lot about her, she's very good at being a spy, basically. But that's not necessarily a great thing to be. And so she has to, so the thing she's very good at isn't like being a wonderful musician. She can't necessarily give back to society or something like that. And so she has to learn the very skill that she has is not necessarily a positive skill. And how does she... how does she redefine her role based on that? But she also has to learn that she does have this power. And to, in a strange way, she can basically change the world around her, but she can't change all of it because there are these large-scale societal strictures. For example, she falls in love with a completely impossible relationship, and she cannot change the world to accept that relationship. It's never going to be possible for her. And that also is a kind of lesson, a sort of lesson we all learn as we grow up, as we're in high school, that the world is going to be uncomfortable and unpleasant in certain, often cultural ways that you can chafe against, but no matter how much money or skill or ability you have, you can't change them. And so that's also part of this journey for her, is learning how far she can push both people and the world around her.
I have just literally had this thought while you were speaking, but I wonder how Sophronia's biography structurally would match up with Lord Akeldama's. I'm going to get that right. I'm going to practice that in front of the mirror every day. Because we're talking about him as a collector and a manipulator and trying to move the world around to suit himself, and she's going through that same process of figuring that out. So I'm just now all of a sudden, perhaps listeners
and
across the universe thought this was obvious.
Well, and if you are a reader of my other book, I've had readers write to me about this and comment on the fact that some of the characters that appear in all of my books, and Lord Akeldama is a great example of that, are different in each of those books. And part of that is because the point of view character is different, the main character is different. And so they notice different things about him. And you'll notice that for Sophronia, Lord Akeldama is a much darker and a much more threatening and sinister character,
mm-hmm.
partly because he is this almost a foil for her, because they do behave towards the world similarly. They're both kind of observers and information gatherers. And interested in manipulation. And so she sees more of him than the main character in my first series, Alexia, does. Alexia sees him as a friend, and she understands that he's old and dark and that he has his own motivations, but she doesn't really, she sees him as sort of a companion, a tea-drinking companion, and hilarious and fun. Whereas Sophronia absolutely does not. She views him as something different. And so she notices different things about him as well. And then in the series I'm writing right now, the main character, Prudence, is the adopted daughter of Lord Akeldama. And so again, she sees completely different things about him and notices different things about him because she has a different kind of intimacy with him. And so that is absolutely also fun. But yeah, you definitely picked up on me playing with that idea that in a strange way, the person in the finishing school books that Sophronia has the most in common with is this ancient, foppish vampire.
with a vest fetish, let's just be honest about that. Which is not bad. Before we get to our last question, I just would like to take a moment to fangirl over your language, over your sentence level writing. I think reading aloud to oneself is a vastly underappreciated pleasure, and that rather than listen to audiobooks all the time, people should really spend some time reading aloud to themselves these books. And I will say that your books give me some of the most pleasurable times of just reading aloud because the words and the sentences feel good to say.
Good mouth feel.
Yes, and I think you've heard me say that word before about your books. Pickleman.
And sometimes I'm kind of teasing you as well if you choose to do something like that, because I'll do really alliterative sentences that are almost tongue twisters. I've had people reading my stuff for audio just really get mad at me because I can make it really difficult. I was raised by a British expat, and she read aloud to me a lot of the British books, Tom's Midnight Garden and The Wind in the Willows and The Water Babies. And so I almost, when I'm writing, I almost think in audiobook format. It's very strange. I also am an author who's very concerned about the sing-song nature that can happen. So authors will talk about developing tick words that you just use too often or repeat too frequently. But I think we can also develop a song-like tick to the quality of our work, to the sentence structure. And so I like to, and I usually try to make this possible at some point in the editing process, read the entire book that I have written out loud to myself in an empty room. That way I can hear the tonality of the words and the sing-song nature of my own, the cadence of my own writing, if you will, and fix it or play with that or keep it. And one way as an author to play with that is to do things like make it choppier when there's more tension or there's a fight sequence, and then lengthen them out. Because I also write a lot of humor in my books, that's another, like, using rule of three and can also play into cadence and execution of sentence structure. So for me, it's really helpful to read the whole thing out loud. I also catch more mistakes that way.
Well, they're a joy to read aloud. Now, finally, because really I want to just lock you in a room with myself and give you lots of tea and scones, and ask you every single detailed question I ever want to know about these. But I promised myself that I would just ask one, because then I can make up the rest as I wish. So the final question is, who is Lord Akeldama's real true love?
All right. Well, this is you will find out in the book I'm writing right now, which is Imprudence, the second Custard Protocol book. Well, people will finally get to learn a lot about Lord Akeldama. And I won't tell you that, but I will tell you he has one. And once you know his real name, you'll know who his grateful lost love was. But his lost love died a long time ago of a fever, and that's all I'm going to tell you.
Foiled again, listeners. I'm foiled again. Now, I'm going to ask all of you to join me in thanking Gail Carriger for being our guest today. But I'm also going to ask you to run to the library or the bookstore and pick up a copy of each and every one of the books in the Solus series or the Parasol Protectorate series. I'm going to ask you to run to the library bookstore and pick up every single copy of the Finishing School series. And I'm going to ask you to make sure that you get for yourself Prudence, the first book in the Custard Protocol series, and order Imprudence, because your life will be made.
Well, you can't yet.
Well, you can put it on a wish list. That's what wish lists are for. Or get a tattoo to remind yourself of this. You know, some sort of reminder to make the correct life choice to read all of Gail Carriger's masterworks. Repeatedly, Because your life will be improved. I don't think this is an unfair statement. I
Oh,
know.
you are so kind. Well, I hope if they don't drastically improve your life, at least they'll make you crave tea and smile quite a bit.
I am going to retire now to a wonderful cup of Darjeeling and a pedophore. But I thank you, Gail, for being with us today.
Thank you so, so much for having me.
Listeners across the universe, this has been the Little Brown School and Library Podcast with author Gail Carriger. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.